You're listening to Tech Talk Radio in your backyard and worldwide on the pod.
Every once in a while, a revolutionary product comes along that changes everything.
It's the first time that Apple have actually decided to tell people about something that they're developing.
High-speed broadband, let's just make sure that we can get it in Australia this year, not next.
The three main spamming countries are the United States, China and South Korea.
And I've got some residual powers.
Sounds like something out of Harry Potter.
Senator Coonan, the voice of reason.
There's a couple of systems on a gantry that's actually based on a military missile tracking system.
You put the date on ePray and you get a whole service just on it.
How does it go?
IE7, you were having trouble installing it because you had a genuine copy of Windows that wouldn't validate properly. What did you have to do to get past that?
Built a new machine.
But how hard can it be?
Well, it's not hard at all.
At the end of the day, the photography is all about the person's eye and what they see.
If you find something that's inappropriate about your child, you need to do something about it because it will not go away.
On air, on the internet and on the pod, you're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Tech Talk Radio. I'm your host, Andrew McComb. Generation Y are making their mark on society in many ways. What with the armament of technology at their disposal in the form of MP3 players, personal communication devices, the internet and social networking, and not to forget the ubiquitous mobile phone, it's no wonder that their legacy will be remembered for generations to come. Throughout the course of history, no other generation has altered the English language to the extent that the youth of today have. Whether it's good or bad, the fact of the matter is there are more new words creeping into today's vocabulary than at any other time in the evolution of the English language. Social networking sites such as Twitter, MySpace and Facebook are as much responsible for the language evolution of today as are the users of the said technology. The internet has certainly made these arenas possible, but the ease of access online through personal, wireless, take-it-anywhere gadgets has also attracted the Gen Ys into cyberspace. Never in the history of the human race have we been so connected. In fact, if you value your personal well-being, you should never try and separate a young person from their mobile phone, as this device is the portal to their social life. The short messaging service, or SMS as we know it, was a technology built for the sole purpose of allowing the telephone company to tell the customer that someone had left them a message on their phone. Little did they know that this technology would become as popular as it has today, and for the purpose in which it was not intended. SMS would also be one of the most inefficient and expensive ways of communicating, yet its simplicity and facelessness is most appealing to its users. To this end, when challenged with a numerical keypad and 160 characters, abbreviations of commonly used words are bound to occur. This has linguists around the world in a flap. So, is instant messaging bad for us? Australian children's language expert and author of Kidspeak, June Factor, urged the less tech-savvy to stop looking at the lingo of messaging in a simple and pejorative manner. Dr. Factor said, "It is always counterproductive to pour scorn, abuse and contempt on a language particular to a subgroup. Rather," she said, "it would be beneficial for teachers to examine instant messaging communications in the classroom and compare and contrast it to other language forms." She went on to say that the dilemma arises when kids see it as a whole language system and are using it to replace the more complex and nuanced forms of writing. When used in context, the increasingly fashionable lingo was a legitimate form of abbreviated language.
This week on Tech Talk Radio,
Michael Cremean joins us live in the studio to answer your questions about anything audio. Adam Turner takes a look at the HTC Shift, and Yellow Pages fights Google with mobile search. First up, though, here's the latest happenings from the Tech Talk News Desk with Dr. Ron.
This is Tech Talk News.
This week on Tech Talk News, confusion as eBay's PayPal exclusivity policy is limited to Australia. A Missouri woman faces criminal charges after bizarre MySpace suicide. Grand Theft Auto 4 boosts game sales. The Australian Computer Society wants guidelines on web and email privacy, and the ACMA finds that landlines are getting left behind. Welcome to Tech Talk News. A month after eBay announced its Safe Payment Initiative, which stipulates the use of eBay-owned PayPal for all financial transactions, corporate communications spokesperson Usha Lieberman has said that eBay will definitely not introduce PayPal only in the United States. However, Mr. Lieberman indicated that Australian users would be forced to use PayPal and that the online auction house would take what was learnt in Australia with PayPal only and apply the knowledge accordingly in other regions. Small online payments competitors and large Australian banks are concerned that eBay, by forcing its customers to use PayPal, will jeopardise the viability of alternative payment systems on sites other than eBay. The ACCC may issue eBay Australia with a competition notice to block the PayPal-only move under the anti-competitive provisions of the Australian Trade Practices Act. In a bizarre chain of online events in the United States, a Missouri woman has been charged for her alleged role in a MySpace online hoax, which 2 years ago resulted in the suicide death of a 13-year-old girl. A Los Angeles federal grand jury last week indicted Ms. Lori Drew on one count of conspiracy and 3 counts of accessing protected computers without authorization to obtain information to inflict emotional distress. Drew is alleged to have created a fake MySpace account to contact a 13-year-old neighbor and friend of her daughter, Megan Mayer. Mayer, however, thought she was chatting with a 16-year-old boy. The online relationship between Drew's alter ego and Mayer allegedly bloomed for several weeks before Mayer started receiving abuse and hate mail. Drew allegedly sent a message to Mayer which said, "The world would be a better place without you." Mayer hanged herself in a bedroom wardrobe soon after receiving the message. U.S. Attorney Mr. Thomas O'Brien said this was the first time the federal statute on accessing protected computers had been used in a social networking case. Mr. O'Brien also said that both the girl and MySpace have been named as victims in the matter. The success of Grand Theft Auto 4 and Nintendo's Wii games console is being attributed to a 47% rise in the sales of video game hardware and software in the United States. The data released by market research firm NPD last week also showed that Grand Theft Auto 4 sold nearly 2.9 million copies in the United States in its first 5 days. GTA 4, recently released by Take-Two Interactive Software, is only available for the Xbox and the PlayStation, and analysts were surprised that game sales weren't mirrored in purchases of new consoles. Meanwhile, Nintendo Wii owners bought more than 1.1 million copies of the cartoony racing game Mario Kart Wii, which was the number 2 game sold in the United States last month. The Australian Computer Society has called on the federal government to adopt guidelines surrounding the use of workplace internet records. ACS President Mr. Kumar Parakala said that historically, Australia has had strong laws regulating interception of telephone communications. Mr. Parakala also said that thought needed to be given to how current privacy laws can be adapted and the appropriate balance achieved to ensure national security is not compromised but people's reasonable expectations of privacy are not violated. Mr. Parakala said that the ACS was particularly concerned with corporate email and web use policies. The ACS wants guidelines on who could authorise the accessing of employee emails, a logging system to identify when email records are accessed, and random auditings of those logs. Employers are also being asked to be more flexible in their approach towards personal use of company IT. Mr. Parakala noted that while many organisations expect staff to be accessible by email and on-call via technology, staff should have the freedom and privacy to conduct reasonable personal affairs on office equipment. And it's official. According to a new report from the Australian Communications and Media Authority, nearly half of household consumers with a telephone in Australia prefer to use their mobiles as a primary means of voice communication. According to the report, 90% of household consumers have both a fixed-line phone and a mobile phone, and of those households, 45% prefer to use mobiles for voice. Following on from another report released in April, showing that there were now almost 22 million mobile phones in Australia, the latest report reveals that just 10% of households with a phone do not have a mobile service. Mobile phones, however, are still used primarily just for voice and SMS, with internet access and data service usage well behind. I'm Dr. Ron, and that's your tech update for this week.
Previously on Tech Talk Radio.
The RBA, the Reserve Bank of Australia, joins the chorus against eBay PayPal exclusivity claim.
If I keep all my documents in my documents...
That's a good place to keep them.
With the tiny little networks that we used to have, the serial networks and so forth, you couldn't run these sort of virtual engines the way that people are doing it now.
The SMS, the telephone companies must be wrapping their heads together with
absolutely.
That.
Absolutely.
Research suggests Microsoft overestimated Vista security.
No.
Say it's not true.
Is it in the same way that we'd have a blind trust in Microsoft if we were using the Mesh product?
There's still some alternatives. There's Microsoft's Paint.
How important do you think you are? Who the hell cares? You don't work for the CIA, and the CIA don't care about you.
Really? It's not sheer bloody-mindedness, then I don't know what is. My book. Face Space.
Micro Who. We were coming on
Micro Who.
Names.
Yeah, Micro Face now. My face. My face. You've been on My Face? Oh, no. Yes.
No, don't stop now, son.
Entertaining, informative, and independent. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio. The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
Yes, don't stop now, son. Still going. Welcome to Tech Talk Radio. Hello, everybody. It's lovely being in your ears again for yet another week in the ever tumultuous world of technology. And there's been some interesting developments this week in fibre and technology and Telstra and things like that. But first, Dr. Ron, how are you this evening?
I'm very well, thanks, Andrew. It's good to be back this week.
It is. I'm glad we are back, just quietly. Hey, yes, also joining us on the panel this evening is Dr. Graham, just plugging himself in. Hello, Graham. How are you?
G'day, Andrew. I'm well, thank you. How are you?
It's good, just in the nick of time, but hey, that's
early.
You're sounding very relaxed.
No point wasting time.
No, absolutely.
Standing around waiting for things, yeah.
And JD, welcome again.
Good evening, everyone.
How's life in the Mac world these days? Anything exciting?
I'm still waiting for the Worldwide Developers Conference to come up on the 9th of June.
Yeah, you're still waiting for your iPhone?
I am.
You're waiting for the announcement of the 3G iPhone.
And a phone call from Steve Jobs.
Oh, yes. That was very funny last week, wasn't it? Poor old Adam. I still don't. I wonder if he's worked out who the snitch was.
He said we had some good sources, didn't he?
Oh, he did. And that's good coming from a journalist.
It is.
Our lips are sealed. But nonetheless, we had a budget released during the week too. Did you know?
Yawn.
Yes. Well, let's speak from a technological point of view. I was quite disappointed that the solar energy portion of the rebate, the $8,000, has been given the old heave-ho, which is really, I think, quite sad in this day and age where we need, well, the environment needs every bit of get up and go that it can get. And I thought that would have been good, despite the fact that, you know, those who can afford them will buy them, but those who now can't afford them are no way going to buy them because there's no incentive there for people to get $8,000 of, you know, your average install, about $15,000, $16,000 for solar energy.
Yeah, it just seems as though that they picked the wrong margin or range of salaries for the means test.
I think it's beyond any means test preventing, you know, greenhouse gas emissions and things like that. Anyone who wants to get out there and do it should be encouraged to do so, regardless of their socioeconomic state, don't you think?
It was all very underwhelming, the delivery of the budget. I've heard figures like 33% of the population are going to be worse off under this budget.
Well, it is a Labor government. You can't say we weren't expecting it, but then again, that's a personal opinion in a lot of respects. So, well, we'll just have to wait and see. But I guess, yeah, a little disappointing in the budget from that point of view. Anyway, let's get on to more technical things. A bit of a dark horse has come into the fibre to the node equation at the moment. Have you heard the Macquarie Bank is now going to get on board and try and put in a bid?
The Macquarie Group, are they?
Macquarie, the biggest investment banking organisation about. Macquarie Bank has refused to comment on the repeated claims it's preparing for a bid, but, you know, gossip, speculation, all that sort of stuff is out there.
Innuendo.
All the major presses at the moment. But they're going to enter the rate as a possibility of another contender. They also have to put up, if they want to become involved with this, the deposit, the bond, which means your fair dinkum. And by the way, did you know Telstra finally gave the secrets to their network to the government? So
did they? Did they release them in the end?
They did. It's all on the table
now.
Well,
they released something. There was a lot of...
you're speculative already, Graham.
Yeah, well, no, there was a lot of backlash from some of the G9 members that what they gave them was...
Oh, really?
Not terribly useful.
Oh, what? They gave them the payphone locations or something?
Or not enough detail where it was needed and things like that.
Okay.
So, yeah.
I haven't read that. So that's a bit of a bummer if that's the case, isn't it?
Mm.
Oh, well,
Maybe there's more
not,
to that.
Not unexpected, though, I have to say.
Well, I don't know. If you expect people to use an existing network and to be able to piggyback onto it, you would think that they would tell you all the information that you need to know, but not so.
Well, you'd think if you bought legitimately a network complete holus bolus from the government that it would be yours to do with what you like and you wouldn't have to tell your competitors about it.
Well, that's true. That's true. Anyway, I guess you could look at it from the other side. That is that infrastructure is already there. Why double it up?
Yeah,
we're all very much anti putting another black cable down the street, aren't we?
Yes, and if I change horses now from the Telstra side to the consumer side, it's absolutely. It was a mistake to give that much infrastructure to a private company. So,
well, I think New Zealand are seeing a bit of that at the moment too, aren't they? Because they've split their telco up into three factions, and I think here's to the New Zealand people and the government for actually doing that.
Hmm. Yeah, and I think that's a much more considered approach, and it means that they can privatise the less sensitive parts without having to have what the loss of control that we've had over some of our fundamental basic infrastructure.
Anyway, fibre to the node. We're going to be talking a little bit more about that later on in the show. Fibre to the house, what some of the other countries are doing. So stay tuned for that. But yes, Macquarie Bank having a bit of a bid, or the rumour is that observers have encouraged any potential move by Macquarie to enter a standalone bid for the construction of the network, saying a new entrant would boost the competitive health of the process.
Well, Macquarie are not lightweights in the business and finance world, are they?
Plenty of spondul behind them too.
They are. They have a reputation for getting things done and for not backing the wrong team. Uh-huh. So to have a force like them in there, I mean, they're big enough and savvy enough to compete with the mass of Telstra.
Macquarie is also massive in the telecommunications sector. It's a very large name. They're very big with call centres.
Macquarie own Broadcasting Australia, which is where all the transmitters are for all the TV stations, or they've got something to do with it. I'm not 100% sure.
Yeah, they do. They do have a foot in that camp as well. But they're also massive in the call centre space and IVR space.
Are they?
Yeah.
Okay. We need banks like that, so that's good. Graham, you made the move to ADSL2 in the course of the last week. Do tell. Was it painless?
It was. It was.
See, not you only can was do it, it.
Not only was it painless.
How long have you been sitting on the fence
it
for?
It was immensely satisfying because I had really, in the last month or so, got to despise with a passion my previous ISP.
Which was? Not just yet?
No. I'll name them. It was GoTalk.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't end up with GoTalk by choice. I ended up with GoTalk because I was with Wild Internet and Telecom, who went bust. And their customer base got sold to GoTalk.
So who are you with now?
Now, I'm with TPG.
Oh, watch out, TPG.
So,
he's got the Moz.
A critic.
So,
no, but all seriousness, how well did the transfer go?
The transfer went really smoothly, but it only went really smoothly because I
knew what you were doing at home.
I knew what I was doing at home, and I had options that a lot of people don't have. I actually had an old modem line that I'd disconnected some time ago at home. And I also had my ADSL on a phone line that I didn't really particularly care whether I kept the number or not. So what I've done is I got Telstra to reconnect my old modem line and give it a new number.
Yeah, and that's a cheap option, isn't it? That's what they call an in-place or an intact?
Yep, an intact.
And it's about $40 or something, isn't it?
It was 59, I think.
Oh, it's gone up.
But, yeah, it wasn't too bad.
Sorry, I haven't done it for a while.
The good thing about it, though, to give Telstra some credit, I rang at about lunchtime. I rang the Telstra number and said, I've got this phone line. It's still connected. There's still even dial tone on it, even though you can't make calls on it.
Yeah, you can ring Telstra on those numbers.
You can ring Telstra.
You can ring.
And probably Triple O on them. Yeah.
Right. Oh, they'll be barring that shortly.
And
barring it for everything else.
They said, yeah, you can have it reconnected and rattle, rattle, rattle. And this is what your phone number will be. And rattle, rattle, rattle. Someone will be connecting that up at 3 o'clock this afternoon. Is that all right? And I said, yeah, that'd be fantastic. So at 2 o'clock, I rang the number they gave me and it said the number you've called is not connected. At 3:05, I rang the number they gave me and it rang.
Well, there you go. I reckon it'd be a computer person just
the
quietly.
The same day.
Scheduled the day before.
Yes. At 3:30, the order went into TPG.
Excellent.
And the a few days later,
had
my ADSL too.
How long? 2, 3 days? 4 days?
Because
that varies these days.
I think I put it in on Wednesday. And I got the service active on the... I put it on Thursday and got the service active the following Tuesday.
That's not bad. A weekend in amongst there, so three or four working days.
It was about four working days.
Well done, TPG.
Yeah, that was really good.
Okay, how far from the exchange are you, and what's your line speed? Technical questions.
Okay.
This is all important, everybody, because if you want to know these things...
What happens with ADSL 2 Plus, for those who don't know, is that the speed that you get depends on how far from the exchange you are, and not physically how far you are as the crow flies, it's how much copper wire there is in between you and the exchange, because if it goes up one street and back down again... You have to count all that length.
Tasmanian listeners, block your ears now.
Yeah. Now, I'm not too far from my local exchange, and I plugged the modem in, and the modem sync speed was about 15 megabits per second.
That's pretty good.
That's about 1.5 times the speed of the old black round network cable that we used to have before we had the...
I was just thinking that. We used to get by with 10 megabits per second.
10 megabits per second
for a long
network
time.
in our offices before we had the current, you know, blue cables that people run around the place.
Yep.
So the sync speed was that. When I actually connect it up and I actually get a service connected over it and I start to actually download data, I get between 11 and 13 megabits per second.
Fantastic.
Which I think is pretty good.
That's good. When you think the federal government's looking for 12 megabits per second is what they want to be able to feed under the broadband guarantee, I think it's the broadband guarantee still, but the fibre to the node, you've hit the mark. In fact, you're going to up the averages there, Graham.
Yeah. So, no, I'm pretty pleased about that. My old connection, by comparison, was 1.5 megabits per second.
Well done.
So
excellent.
Nearly 10 times faster.
Bill Gates is going to build a touch wall. Well, that's his vision anyway. Microsoft Chairman Bill Gates this week took the wraps off a touch wall, 6-foot by 4-foot prototype screen based on Microsoft's Surface Micro Touch technology.
Oh, okay. So he's chopped the top off the table and hung it on the wall.
I reckon so.
Do you remember seeing this table that they had? Surface.
They did.
When was it? Late last year. We were talking about multi-touch
and all that. But sort of
thing. Isn't this going to be a problem issue for height challenged people? 6 foot. That's a long way. You got to put your finger up to the top of the screen. That's a damn big screen.
Maybe some sort of step ladder might be in order.
I wonder if he's thought of that.
Well, anyway, the start button's in the bottom left. I mean, that's okay. It would be bad for the Mac users with the Apple menu on the top.
At the top.
Dear Gates told attendees at the company's CEO Summit 2008 that affordable touchscreens will adorn surfaces in homes and offices in the future. Hopefully not 6-foot by 4-foot, because you wouldn't get to your fridge that way, I wouldn't have thought.
It'd be a fantastic thing in a business or an educational environment to have technology like that. You know, we've moved from... chalkboards, blackboards, to whiteboards, and we've had for a little while sort of moderately sized whiteboards that can actually print out what's on the whiteboard. This is going to be a step even better than that, because you'll be able to draw on it, use it as a blackboard, but also you'll be able to display movies and other content on it. It'll be fantastic in those sorts of environments.
Well, the touch wall differs from the long-established electromagnetic-based whiteboards, which I think is the ones you're talking about, Graham, in that it detects hand or stylus movements using a camera beneath the screen.
Wow. Okay.
So it must be a very wide-angle lens camera if it's a thin screen. Oh, that's all I can say.
No, lots of little cameras.
Yeah, well, that's too.
It's interesting because Smart Technologies have had something similar for 42-inch plasma screens for a couple of years, and I've used that. It's out in Australia. So the technology is not particularly new. Perhaps the scale and the size of the beast is.
6 foot, that's a pretty big screen,
isn't it?
It's
pretty big, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah. They got a cost there, Andrew, for this?
Oh, now you ask me. No, it's... I was just checking.
Just trying to work out if it's going to be reading.
That is the critical thing, whether it's a touchscreen plasma or whether it's this technology. Whichever technology can scale and you can put in affordably into lots and lots of classrooms and lots of boardrooms, meeting rooms, that sort of thing is... absolutely critical.
That's it. If it's only in the price range where the BHP boardroom can afford to buy one, then it's not much use to the rest of us.
That's right.
If we can get it into school.
Well, that's what he says. Bill says the price will come down.
That's good.
Which is good. So well done. Jason Sterling from Genesis comes in. Well, he will be coming in shortly. We got our wires crossed last time. But nonetheless, when he was in, we were talking about voice recognition and how we can use our voices to recognise people.
For security.
Jason's an expert in telephone systems and call centres and that sort of
absolutely,
technology,
absolutely, business-to-business type sort of commerce. Yeah. Boffins at the Fraunhofer Institute for Integrated Circuits in Erlangen.
They're the people that wrote the MP3 codec.
Have demonstrated a rapid face analysis system that can gauge emotional reactions.
What?
So this is going to the next step. Instead of using your voice, you can look at people and judge your facial reactions. Researchers speaking at the CBIT show in Hanover said that with the help of a small camera and some highly complex algorithms, the system can localize human faces, differentiate between genders, and analyze expressions.
Now, you ask any computer user out there, and they will say that that computers have already got this technology in it. Computers can already sense your mood. When you're in a hurry, they slow down. When you're stressed, they crash.
That's a very valid point there, Dr. Graham.
The feature's been photocopiers for years.
Yes, that's right.
Printers? I was just thinking this is great for your
network printers.
For your Facebook entry.
For your MyFace.
Yeah, that's the one. You could actually just, you don't have to worry about, just get your camera out and take a look and, oh, Dr. Ron is unhappy.
Happy face.
Or Dr. Ron is ecstatic.
You won't have to manually update that status.
Right.
It'll do it for you.
Anyway, there you go. That's what boffins are doing in their spare time.
That's a good idea. This sort of technology would be extremely useful for security organisations. I'm thinking people like customs, immigration organisations at airports.
Is this guy looking shifty?
Well, not so much that, but I guess they'll be able to ID. It's all part of the suite of products where they're using facial recognition for security identification.
What about at airports?
That'd be good. That's what I'm thinking. You'd be able to identify if somebody is male or female, or if they're anxious or if they're
stress level.
Relaxed.
Yeah, that's right.
What about you know, you could look up a picture of a database of a photo and a passport or something, and someone walking through there at customs or something.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
And look at it that way. That'd be interesting. Anyway, Tasmanians, a step closer to the backhaul competition. This is interesting, because last week we had some emails, and I did get another one during the week. I just can't lay my fingers on it at the moment. Hopefully I'll find it later on in the show.
Yeah, the issue with Tasmania is the only link between the mainland and Australia is owned by Telstra, and it's hideously expensive, so they've been having trouble getting fast internet connections.
And there's
there.
Another organisation which has a cable between here and there, which is called Basslink.
The power company has dropped a cable through from Victoria's, you know, power generation centre across the ocean to Tasmania, or across the Bass Strait.
Now,
anyway,
the good news is that the Basslink Telecoms has received a carrier licence from the Australian Communications and Media Authority and says its fibre optic cable under Bass Strait could be operational by the end of the year.
That's fantastic.
That's good news.
Because we were talking the other week about it not being utilised at all because of worries about the competition
so, and costing. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, if you're dropping power cables, why wouldn't you just, you know, gaffer tape a few fibre optic cables?
Well, that's obviously what they've done. Yeah, yeah, it's fantastic.
It's a good idea. Some of the Tasmanian user groups are a little bit sceptical about that, but I think it's certainly a start. It's certainly going to raise your hopes, especially if you are suffering the slower speeds. Because it is very frustrating, as Graham will now testament, because now he's got flat knacker ADSL and you probably wondered how you ever live without it.
Yeah, and it's very frustrating when I have to work in places where the speed isn't as fast as it is at home.
Okay, speaking of Apple, because Jason, who are you? Justin.
That's right.
I've got too many J's at the moment.
I'll answer one thing. Sorry.
Justin mentioned earlier, Apple dismissed a Safari vulnerability. Apparently everyone's been getting up and down about the Safari web browser, which I might add, personally, I've been using over Internet Explorer and Firefox, and I like it better.
You like Safari even on the PC, don't
even
you?
Even on the PC, now that I can see the characters.
You reckon it renders the web pages better?
Renders them faster. And it renders them in a quality which is really easy to look, which is what Apple have always been known for. They do things so well. Safari users are at risk of littering their desktop with malicious software because the browser does not ask for a user permission when downloading files in the way that Firefox and Internet Explorer do. So, yes, this is the problem. Is it a problem? What do you reckon?
Well, you can configure it to ask you.
Can you?
It's probably just not out of the box.
Okay, I'll throw that away. That's good. That's great. Well, if I can do that, but that's what everyone's sort of saying, oh, you know, I'm going to cop all this malware and spyware and stuff like that because you can't configure it.
I mean, I've got to say I'm a Firefox user still, but when I have used Safari to download widgets for my OS X desktop, it's always asked me if I want to download it. Well, first you have to tell it, but once it's downloading it, then asks you if you want to install it.
So your OS X browser of choice is Firefox?
Correct. I'm an old Netscape user, so it's not too surprising I've stayed with the
Interesting. Yes.
Well, apparently this request has not gone on deaf ears. Apparently Apple are actually going to bring out in the next version of Safari a ask before download type sort of request when it comes
out.
Maybe
it's something that's in the Mac version that isn't in the Windows version or something like that.
Possibly is, yeah.
All right, just something else that's really interesting. All the Wii users, Nintendo Wiis, Nintendo set to launch a exercise game.
Well, yeah, it looks great. I'm going to get one.
The Wii Fit, that's right. For years, video games have been blamed for turning kids into idle layabouts who only venture off the couch to fill up on potato chips and soda. That's not true, is it?
Yeah.
Is it?
I don't know.
What?
Oh, you're an antagonist tonight,
aren't
you? What
about these dance games that have been around for years?
Have they?
Yeah.
You have to be very energetic, Twister. Don't you?
You mean like the Twisters, the board games, or you?
No, the video game. The dance games where you have the dance floor that lights up and you've got to stand.
You have to mimic the movements with your feet, don't you? And you compete with
other people. Very energetic.
How does that work with the chicken dance? It's all arm movement, isn't it?
I don't think that's the option for the chicken dance.
Okay, good. Nintendo now aims to shatter the image with a game that aims to get players off the couch and lead them to stretch, shake, and sweat their way to a healthier life. Wii Fit, which arrives in the US stores on Monday, which is today actually, is expected to draw new customers to Nintendo's widely popular Wii video game console. Now, that would be a fairly big draw card, especially for parents who go, no, you'll sit on the couch and become a couch potato. This way they'll go, oh, no, there's a video game which actually gets you to do things. It's forecast to be the industry's latest blockbuster game after last month's Grand Theft Auto 4, the criminal actual titled, that racked up $500 million in global sales in 1 week.
But the Nintendo Wii is absolutely decimating the sales of the Xbox and the PlayStation 3 at the moment. There was one of the news items was that last month there were 714,000 units sold in the United States compared with only just under 190,000 of the Xbox and just under 190,000 of the PS3. So they're doing extremely well. Between the Nintendo Wii and Grand Theft Auto, they're going very well.
I wonder what the sound will be like on a game like that.
Grand Theft Auto?
Well, any of those sort of things.
Well, if you had it, the PS3 supports.
Do they come with surround sound?
Oh, absolutely. PS3 does. I'm sure it does. He says, looking at Graham.
We're all gamers in here, can you tell?
No, PS3 owner. I'm sure it does. I'm sure it does.
I'd be very surprised if the sound quality wasn't extraordinary.
Because it's got the built-in Blu-ray player, so it would have to have...
Well, I was trying to do an Anna Corrin then, but it all failed dismally, didn't it? So, because we've got Michael Cremean in the studio. He runs an audio post-production facility and is an expert in all these great things.
He'll know. We'll ask him.
We're going to ask him. Yeah.
Yes, good idea.
I'm sure your son's got... No, not a Wii, no? He has got a Wii. Oh, there you go. So we'll find out all about it after the break. But before we do go to the break, did you know that we actually have a competition going at long last?
A competition?
Yes. Didn't you read the email this morning?
Are we eligible
for it
on the
Nextdoor thing?
Yes, you read it.
I did read it. Yeah.
Oh, excellent. Yes, no, we do have a competition running here.
Can we enter?
No.
Well, that's not very exciting for us. It's exciting for everybody listening, but it's not very exciting for us.
I need some more storage.
Do you? Yeah. Well, maybe our friends at Maxdor might listen to your plea and send you one if you plead hard enough.
Please.
Yes, Maxdor have given us a drive, a 1 terabyte drive, which has got the new encryption software on it. Remember when we had them on the show and they were talking about how they're putting all the encryption stuff, so if someone nicks your hard drive, they can't...
Yeah, you need special software running on the computer to marry up with it.
So we're going
to
give one...
1 terabyte, that's a big drive.
It is, isn't it?
My big drives are measured in the hundreds of gigabytes at the moment, and this is 1,000 gigabytes.
It is 1,000 gigabytes. So you can visit Tech Talk Radio website, and there's an icon on the right-hand side that says something like, enter our 1 terabyte competition. And if you go there you go, it says, click here to win a 1 terabyte Maxdor OneTouch. If you go there and click the link and fill in the email address and all that sort of stuff, you're in the competition.
That's very exciting. That's great.
And why I want to have one.
Yeah, well, actually, the reason why I want to have one is because I wanted to read a few of them out, because some of them are really, really good. Like Peter Bramford says, I'm too slack to back up to DVD. I need the ease of a OneTouch. What have we got another one?
I don't think you're alone there, Peter.
I haven't vetted some of these. I've got to be careful what I've got to read out. I'm getting in trouble like last week. Let me have a bit more of a read. Yes. Anyway, that was good. Work and uni. That's good. That's an honest answer, isn't it? Hello, Jeff. A lot of media training and editing. 1 terabyte would make my life so much easier. Anyway, come along and put your details on the website and add them to the list, and you'll be in the running for a 1 terabyte, which we will be announcing the winner of the 16th of next month.
Excellent. So I've got a month or so.
And hopefully now I'll tell you a little bit more about it.
Recently on Tech Talk Radio, we heard Ben-Hur Castro from Seagate in the United States talk about the new generation of portable hard drives, which not only backs up your files with the push of a button, it also password protects the contents of your drive. Not only does the Maxdor OneTouch 4 Plus provide backups, data storage and protection for your files, it also protects your entire computer system in case of disaster. Now for the good news. Thanks to Maxdor, Tech Talk Radio has a 1 terabyte version of the OneTouch to give away to a lucky Tech Talk Radio listener anywhere in the world, valued at $299. All you have to do is visit the Tech Talk Radio website and tell us in a few short words why you need 1 terabyte of storage. How easy is that? We'll announce the winner on air on Monday the 16th of June. So what are you waiting for? Visit techtalkradio.com.au right now and you could be the proud owner of a 1 terabyte, one touch portable hard drive.
With the federal election approaching, the pollies are doing everything in their power to actually get their message across.
You change it into Little Einstein just to make you feel happier, but he still couldn't get rid of him. You know?
I wonder if it's going to be like Vista.
Why are people standing in thunderstorms with iPods on?
Did you just say instication?
I think that's what I just said.
That's all right. Go on.
I have a cold.
If it is 10%, make everyone pay 10% more and then have the government enforce that they have X amount of green power done by a certain date.
Have you considered a career in politics, Mark? I think that's a fantastic idea.
Being the extremely cynical person that I am...
Look at the map, you idiots.
I'd like to think that it's in my bones.
I do.
I use the force to a large extent.
Yeah, give people understand you. It's the stick and the carrot, isn't it?
That's it.
And this way is both.
Don't eat the carrot, we'll beat you with the stick.
Entertaining, informative, and independent. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
And, of course, as you'd expect with an audio engineer in the studio, the show has started already here, and we're going to turn the microphones on now. You can hear what we're talking about. Anyway, welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. I'm Andrew McComb, Dr. Ron, Graham Callaghan, and JD here in the studio this evening, and we're being joined right now by Michael Kamian, who runs an audio post-production facility in Melbourne, and no stranger to Tech Talk Radio. He has been in here before, so we can ask him all the questions that we didn't get to ask last time round, and add a few new ones to the mix in relation to digital TV and surround sound and all those sorts of good things that we're no doubt sort of plaguing a lot of home theatre enthusiasts at this point in time. Michael, welcome to Tech Talk Radio again.
Thank you. Once every 2 years is obviously enough for you guys.
Ah, this is good. So what's happened in 2 years? Have we seen any great new innovations come through? Or are we just doing things mildly differently? Or what's happening in the last 2 years?
Well, I suppose we're starting to use some of the newer technologies more fully.
Are we?
Is probably what I would say. It's just that, particularly with television, you know, there's been much carry on about the 5.1 and all that sort of thing. But really, there's very little, you know, let's get real here, outside of the feature film that comes up, which has a massive budget and therefore can afford to do those sort of surround things. When it comes to the stations, it's a massive problem to deal with all that.
It's a very expensive process doing that sort of mix, isn't it?
It is, and it's also a much longer process because you have to think about things. I mean, just think for a moment about a drama where you do a reverse over-the-shoulder shot. And we've got the fridge in the kitchen. You know, we're standing in the kitchen. Mm-hmm. The fridge has gone from the left-hand corner to the right-hand back corner. Now, do we switch that around every time we do a reverse shot? Do you think that's going to be slightly distracting for the audience? Or do we keep it in one spot and work out a sort of a vague center of where this should be in the signal?
Or depending on the budget, drop it all together.
Oh, yes, exactly. But all I'm saying is you have to think about things much more deeply when you start going surround in terms of where things are, or you have to take a simple approach, which is to give 10% of the sound to the back channels in terms of your Tweety Birds and things like that, so that two things, it's not distracting, and secondly, with an average production, it comes in at a reasonable budget and you can do it on a weekly basis and then just spot certain things to other channels.
Michael, is there content at the moment which is being made in surround sound specifically for television, or is it still mainly...
Do you mix for telly, I think?
Yeah, is it still mainly movies that
it's still mainly movies.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a massive extension. To be honest, I don't think even a lot of the clients understand that. How much more is involved once you go to 5.1 or 7.1 or whatever you like? It's just a massive, bigger path. I mean, that's why Dolby, quite rightly, came out with Dolby E. When was that? It's a few years ago now. I think I was actually at the launch in the US, strangely enough.
Gee.
So it's a while ago, but we won't go into that. But what was I going to say?
Dolby E,
thank you, get me back on track, was designed largely because they realised that stations couldn't afford to put the infrastructure in for all those extra channels. So Dolby E was a clever data compression to fit all that and more information down a standard stereo set of conductors that the most stations would have as their normal routing around the place. So even analog, you know, plugging would be able to carry this.
Because when certainly when I hear the word Dolby, I automatically think 10, 15, 20 years ago it was
back to your cassette player.
Yeah, it was a noise reduction technology. It was synonymous with noise reduction, yep. Now, so Dolby E is a way of compressing audio. Yeah,
there will be Dolby A to Z if they have their way
right,
over the years.
Right.
But yes, there has been they've gone through a few letters and a lot of domestic standards and a lot of commercial standards in noise reduction, but they're a smart company and they've looked at all these other things. I mean, Dolby AC3 is a data compression, not a multi-channel situation, which is what most people think.
Now, AC3 is what we have on DVDs, isn't it? That's where we get the surround information.
It is basically just a data compression and it is not lossless. And it was used in studios like this for quite a few years before it was ever conceived of in these terms as a straight stereo format for using on cart machines and things to fire off quickly to air. And a very good system, still used in a lot of stations for the music that turns up in the news, things like that. But then, of course, it's been used more completely now. But this is what Dolby E is. It's a very smart compression. Don't ask me to go too far into this because I don't understand it that much myself, but I can tell you that it will take about 10 generations. That's what they say, and probably a lot more, but you know that's what they're willing to bet on without any real loss.
What do you mean by 10 generations without loss?
That means, in a station, you see, you're copying things, although they're becoming more tapeless all the time. They are going through tape from time to time, or they're assembling reels that will have advertisements and things like that. So they take programs, they want to put them into promotions, they want to do things like that, so they get copied back.
So you mean it decodes it back to its audio format and then re-encodes it again at the other end?
Okay.
Well, if you've got enough Dolby units in the place, it does, and that's the one issue with it, is that it does actually delay things 2 frames when they do that, so everything's passing around out of sync.
Oh, good.
And you've got to pull things back into sync, you've got to decode.
Digital television's full of sync issues, isn't it?
Well, it is. We all know that. I mean, I don't know how many people have said, why are the stations all out of sync now? And I say, what have you got? And they said, well, I bought a cheap plasma. And you go, all right, I'll walk away from this now, because immediately you know that the lag time on that is adding to the system. And
that's a good question, actually. We were going to talk about some domestic stuff, and let's just conclude with the Dolby E. So Dolby E is a technology which is really used in the broadcast world.
Yes. It's not for you guys out there. You will never touch it. Do not worry about that 2 frames. That is something that is a bit of a headache for the stations, but it's still better than trying to lay miles and miles of discrete cable to deal with all this.
Okay, now you also mentioned two other technologies back there before, Dolby 5.1 and 7.1. Just briefly, tell us what the difference is between 5.1 and 7.1 is.
A couple of speakers.
That's good.
Basically, I mean, what can I say? How many ears have you got?
Both surround sound systems.
They're surround sound systems, and I mean, it's like anything else. What are we going to push this year? I'm sorry, guys, but you know, I mean, if you like 7 speakers decorating your room, good on you. And if you've got the place to put them and the seats that'll fit around them, and you've got the theatre room, that's fantastic. And it will give you a greater spatial effect, I guess. But how many people actually use it, particularly in terms of mixing, is not a lot, because once again you're making things more complex. It's really the realm of feature film. And it's not going to turn up much in other things.
So if I've got my 5.1 system at home, I've got my speaker right on top of the screen, I've got the speaker either side, and I've got 2 speakers behind me.
You got a lot of speakers, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And then I go from 5 to 7. Where do the other two go?
Exactly.
No,
they are just part of the chain around the room. You just break your surround down into smaller bits, basically.
So there's four speakers around the back.
Back channels, but they're side back channels, if you like. You're just breaking. You can keep going down this path to 9.1 to whatever, right? You're just dividing up. It's like pixels, you know.
Okay. Yep. How many do you want around you? More choices.
How many more birds do you want on separate channels around you?
Is there any content made for seven surround channels? Or?
I think there is some, but it's not much at the moment. It's as I say, it's features that would be passed on to this. And I mean, look, I have no figures to say that this is so, but I would imagine, because in an expensive feature, they might remix things several times, one for your DVD or Blu-ray, one for the theatre, and one for... there's a whole different spectrum they worry about in all of these things, you see, and one for television. Mm.
But if you're watching the Channel 9 news at 6 p.m, you're not going to get a great advantage running 7.1 over 5.1
in LA. But actually, you've hit the one point where the broadcasters will shine. They, if they do a live broadcast, that is where they can use their 5.1 effectively, because instead of this long this process that you have at the moment with anything post-produced, where you have to keep re-recording and re-recording and then making mixes for all these things, which is what holds the whole thing up and makes it impractical for a lot of productions. When it comes to a major live broadcast, after they've actually gone round, set up all the microphones and sorted that out, for a Logies or something like that.
Oh, yeah.
Once they've set it up, it is basically open a group on the desk and it's all there, you see. So it doesn't matter how many times you cut between cameras and things like that, they can actually have that field set up properly.
It'd be great for the golf, don't you think? You'd get a bird loop in the background going tweet, tweet, tweet.
Yes, and somebody chasing the ball with a radio.
I've noticed this at the football, where the crowd noise is coming out of the rear channels and that sort of stuff.
So. Well, I've had some classic disasters with that, as you're probably aware, when they first tried this out a few years ago and they put the mics a bit too close to some of the members of the audience.
Yeah, the who'd had members of
just
the community.
The odd beverage and and who had a few extra comments to make about the umpire before they threw the can at them.
But yeah, thinking about television... digital television and the bandwidth that comes down to your TV and your lounge room, Michael, is this going to impact on the bandwidth that's available for the video?
Yes, absolutely.
So, my pictures at the moment are going to look even grungier and even more pixelated supposedly high def channels.
No. It is as is. I mean, it's allocated. They're not going to change that.
But, so there's a fixed bandwidth for the audio is separate from the video. They can't.
Yeah.
Putting a 7.1 sound channel on it isn't.
Well, they would have to work
some other, from the video.
Don't say it's beyond the realm of possibility, but I'm just saying yes, they've got their allocated area. They will not muck around with that. So
interesting.
That's good to know.
Mm.
As long as they don't muck around with it, I think that's the key to it, isn't it? And as long as they use it wisely out there and they don't give absolutely, you know, consumers all these sounds and all sorts of strange things, which, hey, it's a new toy. I remember, because speaking from video, when we used to get all the, you know, video effects units come out, which we could use on air, guess who's got one of those? You can see silly things happening on the screen. Hopefully they don't go the same way with sound and have all sorts of funny things popping out the back speakers and things.
I know. Well, the thing is, they will do exactly what people want. I mean... the whole point of having a 5.1, 7.1 and all that sort of thing is related to the folks out there, basically. If they want to go down the path of special effects and there's a big market for that, then that all makes sense, because you're going to pick films that have helicopters blowing up in this side and, spaceships flying across the back. If you like watching sensitive foreign drama... that might run at the Rivoli, you're not really going to achieve much with that setup.
It's like any technology, isn't it? I mean, when we first got stereo records, there were certain bands that put the music all in one channel and the voices
early
all
Beatles,
in the other
channel.
Early
Beatles.
Early stereo
bring
Beatles
the original recordings
classic.
Out. Yep, you know, McCartney's over that side and Lennon's over that side singing through a pickup on his guitar.
That's right. And then when... you know, colour TV came out and everybody went and bought a colour TV and they grabbed that colour control and they slid it all the way across to the right.
Ooh,
so
yes.
That the brightness, so that the colours were outrageous.
They still do that out of the box when you buy a plasma. What do you mean? When they used to, they still do.
But now, we've got stereo recordings that sound more reasonable. We've got televisions that produce more realistic
which
colour.
Which makes you wonder why people want 5.1 for their standard music listening anyway, because if you go for reasonable with any band... that normally stands in front of you, I'm not quite sure what the content is coming out of the back other than the audience and the beer cans again.
Well, for some sort of recordings, that's appropriate.
It
I suppose,
is,
but...
absolutely. But all I'm saying is there's still... I always get back to the fact that please, people, remember that the left and right speakers are the most important one if you're going to use the system for music, because that is actually the image you're most concerned with, and the rest will actually confuse in a normal music. Once again, unless you listen to 100% digitally... generated stuff, in which case ping pong bing around the room is what you want, and that's fine. But I'm just saying, for those who are after you know, the real affair with some small group, they're actually better off spending a lot of money on those two front speakers,
and not worry and use the old cheap speakers at the back.
Pretty much, yeah.
Fair enough.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about, I guess, home theatre stuff. Plasmas, which Michael alluded to earlier, and audio delays and plasmas. Why you shouldn't buy a cheap one, I guess, is going to be the answer to the question. And all sorts of other audio things after this.
Compelling.
Every once in a while, a revolutionary product comes along that changes everything.
Judicious.
The question is really whether young people particularly are addicted to being connected to other people all the time.
Historical.
Today is a very important day in Australia's history. This is the day, the 6th of October, in 2006, that life in Australia will be changed forever.
Caring.
I know as a parent, I would often say to my children, you've just spoken to this person for 8 hours at school, how can you sit online and chat to them for another 5 hours?
You heard of road rage? What about web rage?
They should be wearing a mask and carrying a gun.
Relations between Telstra and the federal government have been extremely strained almost from the moment Sol Trujillo became chief executive.
Optus had, again, had quite a good quarter, but its 3G service is very low profile at the moment.
And the Queen's got an iPad.
Eddie's got one.
Yeah.
Wonder what she listens to. She'll probably listen to us.
An unexpectedly high number of voters swamped the system. Well, what did they expect?
Controversial.
Less attention is paid to the equally interesting question, should journalists blog?
Magical.
And I've got some residual powers.
Ambitious.
High-speed broadband, it's available in most of Asia as well as being in the rest of the world. Let's just make sure that we can get it in Australia this year, not next.
Religion.
Talking of the Roman Catholics, I have been on Vatican Radio.
Comedy.
You put the date on ePray, and you get a whole service. Just on. How does it go? It goes.
Insightful, entertaining, and informative. Tech Talk Radio. More than just technology.
It's a strictly rehearsed and finely polished program.
Have you heard something on Tech Talk Radio worth talking about? Are you looking to share your technical dilemmas or opinions with like-minded Tech Talk Radio listeners? Well, now you can. Introducing the Tech Talk Radio web forum. Visit forum.techtalkradio.com.au and join our community. It's free and on a web browser near you. The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
And welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. Andrew McComb, Dr. Ron, Graham Callaghan, JD, and Michael Cremean in this evening. Michael's an audio engineer with Audacious Productions in Melbourne, and he mixes television commercials and television programs and all that sort of stuff, and does a lot of mine, actually, just to that's why he's here in the studio with us this evening. He even mixed some of the promos that you've heard going to air on this.
You said you were going to pay the bill after this, didn't you?
I did, absolutely. Yes. Do I owe you money? Okay, good. Let's talk about plasma displays, because you mentioned it before. Audio and these sort of devices, is there really a delay in them?
Oh, yeah. I mean, just as you will see listed in your everyday listing in the Green Guide or wherever, with all the screens vary.
Mm-hmm.
The screens you buy as televisions do exactly the same thing. They can be quite slow. They can be 12 millisecond delays.
And that's adding a lot.
Yeah, and you can...
Nearly quarter of a second. A bit less than quarter of a second.
And when you add that into... an imperfect system like television as it is, because it's just a natural fact that things get bounced around on satellites and go through all sorts of processes to get to air. And there are, despite, in fairness to the networks, their best efforts most of the time to keep things in sync, things creep in, particularly when you get them from strange sources overseas where they don't care, and an extra frame store in the line which delays something.
Yeah, it's just that, you know, rhetorical thing. Each little bit adds to the compounds the issue, doesn't it?
Exactly.
And Michael, you're talking about a delay between the actual
lip sync
audio and the video.
Yeah, I'm not making this clear, am I? A delay between sound and pictures. Sometimes it's one way and sometimes it's the other.
I thought it was just me, my brain getting old and wearing out.
But oh, there it's
that
as well.
I thought it was, but there is a real delay there as well.
Yes, absolutely.
That's what I like about radio.
So
you,
what
you it, can't tell.
And it's thrown a loop with one, well, it has a few times when people leapt on the technology before they realised too. Including a couple of television stations that actually outfitted themselves almost completely with plasmas when they first came out and then discovered the issue, because nobody was talking about it, particularly the manufacturers.
So the the delay can be affected even by the screen at the very end of the process. Your screen hanging up in your lounge room can have a delay.
Yes, absolutely.
That's a bit scary.
So, therefore, in actual fact, I hate to tell you this, but you were better off with the CRT in terms of delay, because that was the... That was what the system was. That was what the system was set up for.
Somebody in this studio continually tells me that CRTs are better.
Well, there's, you know, we're still will get there. But as you are well aware, you still see jitter and things even on the big screens when things move across, and that's, you know, all to do with it too. But we're talking about sound relationship here in particular, and that, yes, that can be well out, and that's why they're advertising now more and more that they're getting confident. We've only got a 4-millisecond delay or a 2-millisecond delay, because they've caught up now, or they're trying to. But certainly, it's the old thing of you get what you pay for.
So cheap is not necessarily good for audio in a plasma or an LCD.
Just the same as it isn't with the pictures. It's the same. Yes, with the audio.
So, Michael, is the delay standard? Like, is it preset? Is it 12 milliseconds across the board for one particular screen? Or can it vary according to the compression?
I'm sorry. I see what you're saying.
So, if I'm setting up the delay in my TV and
yes,
I say
yes,
20
yes,
milliseconds,
absolutely.
That will always work? Or?
You're quite correct. If you've got particularly most of the surround systems come with that delay arrangement, yes, if the better ones do anyway, for the whole set of channels, for setting the relationship. And yes, if you knew the delay, if you could read it off your instructions that came with the set, yes, you could delay the system to come back into sync.
So just dial it up until the lip sync's right.
Yes, yes. In fact, I remember very early on in a tie-up with a fairly upmarket hi-fi place I used to do some things for, but he's not paying for the advertising, so I won't go there. They were into the big screens very early on, and a lot of this problem was happening with the early setups, and they were actually bringing in little separate delay line boxes that they were sitting in each channel and dialing them up. Goodness. To get everything into line.
So tell me about the hardware these days. Obviously, there's cheap stuff out there in the market.
Yeah.
You see them in some of the magazines and local newspapers for surround sound system for $600.
Yeah.
And then you see the other end of the equation, surround sound systems for $6,000 or $10,000. Mm. Surely there's a fairly sizable difference in what you pay for in those sort of environments.
Yeah, I mean, it's... Like all these things, there is a sort of a diminishing return for your money, I guess.
So what's good to pay these days? What would you pay for a reasonable system?
It depends what you call reasonable. If you mean something that's an extension off the kitchen or something for your home theatre.
Well, if you look at it this way, people are spending $2,000, $3,000 on a plasma. If you're going to spend that amount of money on a big screen, you've got to be proportionally spending that sort of money on a surround system.
You haven't even entered the real world of hi-fi, have you?
No.
No.
I do. How much?
Guys, you can spend $15,000 on a set of front speakers.
Fantastic. Where do I sign up?
Yeah. And they'll be fantastic.
But actually, the Tech Talk Radio's next competition after the Maxtor Drive will be a $15,000. No, I won't. I'm only joking.
That's good.
But there are some massive... to be honest, I can't keep pace with the rate of change in the amplifier units at the moment. In 12 months, the number of updates that are being brought out in these systems... I mean, the latest ones in the really upmarket surround amplifiers... set themselves up, basically. They don't just run the white noise and the pink noise now, but they listen back to everything. They get the right delay between things. They set it up. You just set it up, run.
All right. You've just opened up Pandora's box now. What's white noise and what's pink noise?
They're just a different equalization of noise. One is related to the pink noise is related to the sensitivity to different frequencies in the ear. So, in other words, it's proportional noise to different frequencies, whereas the other is just the same power coming out at all frequencies.
Okay.
Does that make any sense?
It sort of does. So, the older you get, the less pink you get. Is that right?
Well...
Because your hearing falls off and all that.
Well, the pink noise is more relevant.
Is it?
Really.
It's what you hear?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because it's like... older sound mixers, you tend to ride the highs a bit...
Oh, because their natural hearing has fallen off a little bit.
Correct.
Absolutely. Yeah. I know. Cameramen like that, they wear glasses.
Mm.
It's good, isn't it?
Yes.
Michael, I'm looking at installing a new surround sound system at home.
Yes.
What are your thoughts on wired speakers versus wireless speakers?
I'd always take wired first if I had the option.
There's a lot of packages that we're seeing now which offer the wireless solution and seems at face value to be a good idea if you don't want to be drilling holes in walls.
Absolutely. I mean, all these things are always a trade-off. And once again, you get what you pay for. It's like wireless headphones. You can buy some great wireless headphones, but if you walk into a store and buy the $25 special hanging off the front, they'll be rubbish.
Mm.
And there's plenty of them out there too. They're designed to look like the things you're wearing, Sennheisers. There you are, got to plug it. but they're not a scratch on them. But, you know, people still buy them. They say, ah, look, it must be all right. It looks like the Sennheiser.
The wireless ones still need to be powered though?
Yes.
So
yes.
Is that usually like with a... I haven't ever set one of these systems up. Do you need a plug pack per speaker or are they battery powered? How are they usually powered?
I don't think you'd be running a battery pack on to power a speaker. I think you'd be plugging it in.
So you're still going to need a power point anyway near every speaker.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
it defeats the purpose.
It does,
really,
doesn't it? You're still running cables there.
Yeah.
And it's another unpredictable delay in your sound too to get it on and off the wireless channel. Yeah.
I'm more concerned at the moment with the... worrying number of queries I've had about what type of speaker is a good quality one in the ones that actually flush mount in the walls, and the answer to that is none.
Really? People asking you that question?
Yes, I'm surprised in this day and age that people still haven't got the message that speakers that are mounted into the walls, as in flush mounted, like you would see in an elevator.
My parents have got
that's
some of
what
these
they
in
sound
the roof.
Like an elevator.
Why is that?
Because any good speaker, what's the first thing you notice about it?
Needs an enclosure, doesn't it?
Well, it's a function of the sound. Yes, it's tuned. It is a part of the whole process. So although there are, as in anything else, these wall mount ones, there are some better ones. LTEC make ones which are obviously better than some of the others, and there are some better. But when it comes down to comparing that with the box speaker, no comparison, because the box for a start. It's a point source. The sound travels off the surface and gives you an image. The moment you flush mount it on the wall, everything's just traveling along the wall and connecting to the next speaker. So you just get this mishmash, no image. You're ruining the image of the sound, basically, and you end up sounding like a hotel foyer.
I guess people are trying to be clever and they're trying to design their own home cinemas, and they're thinking, well, I've got the nice big screen there, I'll flush mount the speakers, it'll look really nice.
Cinemas don't flush mount their speakers.
They actually have
large carpeted areas or screened areas that look like solid walls, but they're not, and there's actually speaker boxes behind there.
Well, if you walk into any
of the cinemas, they've all got their surround things normally a metre off the wall too, haven't they?
They're focusing the speakers. Yeah.
That's what I love about sound. It's very selfish. You really have to be centering in front before it to work properly, don't you? Unlike television or video in general.
People would like it to be otherwise, but X marks the spot.
It does, doesn't it? You can all fight for the middle seat in the cinema, but there you go. All right, we'll take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the loudness of TVCs. Television commercials, for those not in the game. Are they really as loud as you think they are? Well, we'll dispel some of the rumours and fuel others, I think.
Recently on Tech Talk Radio, we heard Ben-Hur Castro from Seagate in the United States talk about the new generation of portable hard drives, which not only backs up your files with the push of a button, it also password protects the contents of your drive. Not only does the MaxTor OneTouch 4 Plus provide backups, data storage and protection for your files, it also protects your entire computer system in case of disaster. Now for the good news. Thanks to MaxTor, Tech Talk Radio has a 1 terabyte version of the OneTouch to give away to a lucky Tech Talk Radio listener anywhere in the world, valued at $299. All you have to do is visit the Tech Talk Radio website and tell us in a few short words why you need 1 terabyte of storage. How easy is that? We'll announce the winner on air on Monday the 16th of June. So what are you waiting for? Visit techtalkradio.com.au right now and you could be the proud owner of a 1 terabyte, one-touch portable hard drive.
The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
Dynamic range. It's a wonderful thing. It's loudness and softness, and there's quite a bit of it in a movie these days. when you put that up against a television commercial, the TV commercials seem louder, according to some people. Is this the case?
I reckon they do. I reckon they're much louder.
Is this the case, Michael?
I'll tell you why I reckon that, because I have to turn the volume down when the commercials come on, because they're louder than the program. They seem louder.
Uh-huh.
And then I always crank it back up again.
You wouldn't do that, would you, Michael?
Yeah, you have to turn it up to hear the dialogue in the normal program. Yeah,
you do. Yeah. You do. My father complains about that all the time.
I'll
turn the subtitles on.
That'll do it.
The subtitles louder? No, sorry.
No, but the braille's violent. Sorry, had to get that one in. Listen.
He's being very non-committal, listen, isn't he?
Yeah. I got to say, I think the Cowboys were more back in the analog era when it was all analog, and there were no agreements or anything. And I used to work in advertising way back then too, and basically, a whole pile of people from an agency, when a commercial was being mixed, would file in to the back of a studio and sit down, and the bloke at the front would sweat. And they'd say, louder, 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 and that's what they'd get. They wouldn't understand what they're doing, mind you. I mean, but it was, some studios admit to having a panel of lights they used to turn on to impress people too that had nothing to do with the gear. But
still do.
But it's, not going there. There certainly was a push to do that until somebody said, stop, enough, and all of that. But just to look at it from another angle, please keep in mind that the stations want the money from the advertisers. They want you to keep watching and listening and don't want you to switch off. So it's not actually in their interests to annoy you to death either.
That's never stopped them before, though.
Well, the situation certainly in analog land was quite clear, and that was that stations have station clippers, which stop everything from rising above a certain level, but they have automated systems below that, although way back, of course, you used to have a person riding the controls. But the aim of the game is not to push the transmitter into clipping. And the thing about making a commercial subjectively loud is that you crush the dynamics, which means the lowest low is closer to the highest high. Now, when that passes all the people in the middle and gets to the transmitter, or in the path to the transmitter, the station clipper takes over and everything rises up to whatever that preset level is. So if the peaks, if I'm not getting too far into things here, the peaks in an ordinary drama are well above the average level because they want to be able to reach that note that'll make you jump. So the average dialogue level and everything, and it's more so in films where you're in a quiet cinema than it is when it's mixed for television, but the same still applies. They keep it at a certain level and so that they can ride it high when they want to for effect. But when you get to the commercial break, they just want you to get it. So certainly back in the analog days, they had woken up to the fact that if you crushed everything up, it would all rise up, quite apart from anything the station wanted to do, because the station clipper would hit normal programming, hold the peaks at a certain level, and all the average sound would be well below that. But when you came to the commercial, it would do the same thing. It would try and hold the peaks there, but the average level was closer to that point. Now, all the monitoring levels and all that also were less sophisticated then, so things got through.
You're really sort of saying that television commercials now seem louder because we turn the lows up to match the highs, or the loudness, I guess. So when loudness sits at a certain level, which is the legal loudness, we're pulling all of our soft whispers up to meet those loudnesses.
That's not a bad way to put it. That was how it used to work, but because everyone's complained and because the broadcasters have also really not entirely enjoyed the way the commercials were being delivered to them, they've got into an agreement now, which you were actually, if you're supplying a commercial, you actually have to specify that you agree to this before they'll take the commercial.
Yeah, we have to tick the box now. We have to be OP48 compliant.
That is the one. And this is basically a general agreement to keep the subjective loudness of the commercials within a certain range. Because it is it's not like a picture where you've got a cut-off point for the left, the right, the top and the left of the picture and the brightness and all of this sort of thing. Sound is a much harder thing to get a grip on because it's all about spectrum. And which bits you compress and which ones you don't. And it is easier to measure now than it was because we've become more sophisticated about our measuring devices. which are becoming more universal. In fact, there's one that they're looking at to be adopted as a general measuring stick, if you like, in Europe at the moment, that will probably come over here in the not-too-distant future, and everyone will have
to comply to it. That's got to be good. OP48 is available at freetvaustralia.com.au for those of you who want to go and have a read on those technically inclined. It was funny, actually. I got some specifications sent across to me the other day from Channel 10, and in eras gone by, the video specifications are normally much more detailed and much more use much more paper than what the audio does. But now it's the other way around. Yeah. The audio specifications go over three or four pieces of paper, and video is just one now. Mm.
There's good reasons for that too, is because they're broadcasting in analog, digital, and high def, and all of those have got different specifications. So they're trying to keep all that's coming into the station, but within the vague area of all of those three, so that they don't lose the plot on any of those broadcasts, and so they're much tighter. But I would also like to just a little anecdote here. Anecdote on the fact that a lot of these rules were often broken by people in the on the creative side of the game, if you like, unintentionally too, just because they didn't understand what they were
doing.
Trying
to get an effect or something like that.
Yeah, there was one guy I know who will remain unnamed, but it wasn't really his fault. He wanted the sound of he was at a studio that was feeding to me and a whole lot of other places on a regular basis, on a daily basis with a commercial. He wanted a sound like old Valve radio. And unfortunately, at the studio he was at, he was teamed up with a guy who was a bit, basically a trainee. Maybe they knew something about this guy to give him this guy to work with. But anyway, he kept saying, I want that old Valve sound, you know, with a bit of distortion, a bit grungy and all that sort of thing. Well, there are ways of creating that within a system and still controlling the levels, basically.
So this is like an effect that he wanted on
It was an effect he wanted on the recording.
Yeah, he wanted distorted and things.
Yeah, right. that sort of old Valve sort of sound like a radio. And
you do that very well.
Thank you very much. And he got what he wanted, but he got it because the guy didn't understand what he was doing. He just pushed all the faders up until it distorted, and he said, that was great. Now, that's what got taped, which was totally out of all specification, and actually, because he didn't understand, that went off to the stations. Now, the stations refused to play them, and he hit the roof. He was going, you're cutting into my creative, blah, 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 and all this sort of thing, and they had to explain to him what was wrong. So, you know, sometimes it's not like that. And there was another guy who, this applies to me too, who on one occasion rang me up saying, your commercial you mixed for me isn't loud enough. And I said, oh, right, why? And he said, it's just not loud enough. And I said, well, how did you gauge this? And he said, well, you know that VHS copy, it was a while ago, you gave me after we'd finished. I said, yes. And he said, well, I took it home and I set it up in the video and I've got quite a good sound system at home. And I watched and waited for a commercial break. And when all the ads came on, after a few commercials, I quickly pushed over to the VHS and played it. It wasn't as loud.
Yeah, good. That's not very scientific, Michael.
Well, it was trying to explain
creatives
it to this
scientific.
Man.
Creatives aren't scientific. That's the thing.
Yeah. And this was a major from a major agency. So you've got to realise, you know, sometimes these guys are asking for things they don't know what they're asking for.
Mm. Michael, it's been an enlightening evening, I guess, talking about all these sort of things. We can go on for hours about audio. It's a very interesting topic and very passionate about it for some people too, especially when you do radio and television for a living. You can certainly talk about things like sound effects and how you place them and things like that. Oh, it's fascinating. But thank you for coming in this evening. Thanks, Rob, for letting you come out tonight, because I know you've probably got a few other things you should be doing. But we've learned a lot. It's been great. Again, we'll have you back in another 2 years.
I was going to say, can you hold the doors up that long? Yes.
All right, you're listening to Tech Talk Radio. You've been listening to Michael Cremeen there from Audacious Productions. He is a proprietor of an audio production facility in Melbourne who does lots of TV shows. You fish a bit, you cook a bit. All those sorts of things, and does the odd radio commercial here, there, and everywhere as well. We'll be back with more Adam Turner's coming up shortly with his View from the Couch after this.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Have you heard something on Tech Talk Radio worth talking about? Are you looking to share your technical dilemmas or opinions with like-minded Tech Talk Radio listeners? Well, now you can. Introducing the Tech Talk Radio web forum. Visit forum.techtalkradio.com.au and join our community. It's free and on a web browser near you.
the panel on Tech Talk Radio.
Hey, welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. Andrew McComb, Dr. Ron Graham Callaghan, JD here at the panel. Now, boys, you're a Jazz Jam user, aren't you, Dr. Ron?
I am.
What do you reckon? Does it serve your needs from a device which lets you send emails and do all sorts of things like that?
It does. It serves my needs very well for...
It's a stylus device, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
I've never come to terms with styluses, to be quite honest.
I've always used styluses. Going back to the days of my very early Palm Pilot, I think that was the first device I had with a stylus.
Yeah.
A Palm Pilot 3C, I think I had, and then... I've had phones like the Sony Ericsson P800, and I've had the Jazz Jam. I've always had devices with a stylus.
What about you, Justin?
Yeah, Apple Newton came out with a stylus.
That's it. The Newton was the first thing out that came out with a stylus, wasn't it?
Absolutely.
Did you have one of those? Of course you would. That was a very silly question. Does it still work?
Oh,
yes, of course it does. Yes. Does it run OS X?
No, it doesn't. Newton operating system, much better than OS X.
Oh, really? Yeah. In what way? It worked.
It does some interesting things, but that's for another show, probably.
Absolutely. Adam Turner, our regular on our program, got hold of another device that HTC make, which is called the... what do you call it? The Shift, the HTC Shift. Have you seen these things? They're like the size of a phone you used to carry around, Dr. Ron.
No, I've seen a big brick
sort of thing with laptops, things, and all that sort of stuff.
I've seen the Titan, which was a fairly new HTC device. This might be newer again.
You can actually put a SIM in there and use a third generation network down the track if you wanted to as well.
Okay,
but you can't make calls on it. Anyway, I'll let Adam tell you all about the HTC Shift.
Adam Turner's View from the Couch on Tech Talk Radio.
The HTC Shift is one of those gadgets that can't decide if it's a computer or a smartphone. Design-wise, the Shift is a smartphone on steroids. It looks like a small tablet PC with a 7-inch LCD screen, making it roughly the size of an A4 sheet of paper folded in half. It's only 25mm thick, which is roughly an inch in the old money. Now, the Shift weighs in at 800 grams and sits perfectly in two hands if you hold it like a handheld computer game. It features Wi-Fi access for talking to your local network, but it also takes a SIM card for connecting to a HSDPA high-speed mobile phone network. Now, the Shift is really two devices in one and actually features two processors. The first processor is for running Windows Vista like a standard computer. The second processor is for SnapView, which is a stripped-down version of Windows Mobile 6, Microsoft's operating system for mobile phones. Because they run on different processors, even when Vista is shut down, you can press a button and launch SnapView instantly. It lets you check your email, check your calendar, and use SMS, but you can't actually make phone calls. Now, this is kind of annoying. Obviously, the Shift is too big to hold up to your head like a handset, but you could always use a Bluetooth wireless headset. The Shift has a touchscreen, and it comes with a stylus like a mobile phone. But the thing that makes the Shift really interesting is that you can slide the screen up to discover a full QWERTY keyboard underneath. The screen even tilts up so you can sit it on your lap or on a desk. I own an iMate Jazz Jam mobile phone, which is also made by HTC, and is roughly the same design as the Shift, but obviously much smaller. I can hold the Jazz Jam like a Game Boy, slide out the keyboard and type with my thumbs. I was disappointed to find the Shift is too wide to do the same thing, and other people I've shown it to said the same thing. At the same time, the Shift's not quite wide enough to type on normally, as the keyboard is only 2/3 the size of the keyboard on my MacBook notebook. Such a keyboard might be handy for replying to emails, but I certainly wouldn't want to use the Shift to take notes in a lecture or a press conference. The keyboard is even smaller than the keyboard on the tiny ASUS EPC, which a few of my fellow IT journos have bought to use while they're on the road. The difference is that the EPC costs $500 Aussie, whereas the Shift costs $2,000. If you decide to slide away the keyboard and use the Shift more like a tablet PC with a stylus, you'll be frustrated to discover that you can't rotate the display so you can use it in portrait mode like a notepad. The small screen is also limiting for handwriting recognition, and the fact that it's a touchscreen makes it easy to accidentally brush the screen while you're writing on it. The lack of portrait mode means it's not a great ebook reader either. Another disappointment is the short 120-minute battery life in Vista mode. Too big to be a decent phone, too small to be a decent notebook or a tablet PC, the Shift hangs in limbo. To be my dream gadget, it needs a bigger keyboard, but I don't want the device to be any bigger. This seems to defy the laws of physics, But the simple answer is to design a fold-out keyboard that opens up like a piece of origami. Such keyboards are already under development, and I'm hanging out to see one on a device such as the HTC Shift. If you're looking for a large touchscreen smartphone that's not actually a phone, or a small tablet PC that won't work in portrait mode, the HTC Shift could be your dream device. If you're looking primarily for a device to write on, you might be better served by a sub-notebook with a bigger keyboard, such as the cheap and simple ASUS EPC.
Entertaining, informative, and independent. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
There's a lot of things it isn't, isn't there?
Oh, this is a continuing problem with these devices, isn't it? That there's they still, with all the PDAs, smartphones, tablet PCs, all those sorts of devices, there still isn't any one that's got it quite right yet. Someone will build one. In the next few years, someone will build one that gets it right. But we haven't seen it yet.
No, it's only a matter of time. But as you say, and the smart keyboard things that Adam was talking about there, Dr. Ron's got one here. You can fold it out.
You've got a roll-up keyboard here, haven't you, Dr. Flexible keyboard?
Sorry, I'll push that button. Try again.
That's all right. I do have a foldable keyboard. Yeah, you can roll it up into a ball. And
is it any good?
Chuck it in your briefcase.
Like, compared to a normal keyboard, or would you prefer a normal keyboard?
I prefer a normal keyboard. Yeah, I would prefer a normal one. This has got advantages because it's portable.
Mm-hmm.
And it's fairly durable, but in terms of it being comfortable to type with for any length of time, I'd say
no. It's not hugely convenient either. It's not integrated into your device. You have to unroll it and plug it in and all that sort of stuff. So
that's it. Now, you had a small HTC model communications device going back a few months. But
yeah, I've still got it. I use it for work.
Do you use it as a phone or a PDA?
I use it as both. I don't use the PDA functions of it that much, but I find it frustrating to have a phone that runs within Windows, even Windows Mobile.
Yeah.
Because it just takes too long to do things, and it locks up too often. You need to control or delete and reset your phone. Or in this case, push the little button on the bottom of the phone too often. A phone shouldn't hang. A phone shouldn't take 3 seconds to change
Justin's
from one screen
got a big
to another.
Smirk on his face over here.
So my aim iMate does exactly the same thing.
Oh, does it?
Yeah. But yeah, your Newton probably didn't. But when the phone rings on my Jazz Jam or whatever it is, it takes so long from when it gets the signal from the network to ring, and then it has to wake up Windows and switch to the phone application and find the
and by the time
ring
it has, it's gone to message bank.
And that's right. And the phone rings literally two rings and then goes to message bank because I've missed the first three rings while it mucks around trying to find.
I've been wondering
ring.
About
wave.
That. My phone rings three times and then it's gone. I often wonder that.
Yeah,
that'll be it.
Yeah, if you actually ring it from a phone that's right beside it, you'll see that it starts ringing long before you actually hear it ring.
And the problem is the operating system that Graham's described is going through the process.
Never realized that.
Waking up and finding a file and actually.
So buyer beware, someone who buys a phone that is ringing on an operating system.
Oh, yeah, loading up the media player in the background and finding the file and starting to play it. And I had the exact same problem,
yeah.
Graham. And look, my device works very well as a PDA and it's great
as
a Wi-Fi device. But as a telephone, to use it for voice calls, it's not.
It works, but it's just too frustrating.
It's not there yet.
A phone should be better than that.
Yes, well said. Well, the iPhone's out. Maybe try that. See if it takes two or three rings to go before it connects. I don't think it would.
No, it possibly wouldn't.
But it's running on OS X. It's got its own operating system there in the background. Not
it's probably
Windows,
optimized a little bit better to do that phone job too, rather than being a PC with a phone sort of tacked on the back of it.
We were talking earlier on in the show about fibre to the node and things like that. Well, how about this for fibre to the home? That is a bit of blue cable coming up to your very doorstep. That's got to be the ultimate, doesn't it?
Yep, I want it. Can I have it tomorrow?
New global rankings reveal that fibre to the house leaders are basically Hong Kong, South Korea and Japan are the world leaders in connecting their homes via fibre optics. This is according to a global ranking of fibre to the home market penetration. The ranking was issued by FTTH Councils of Asia Pacific, Europe and North America. So it just goes to show that Asia is really beating the Americas too. In a lot of respects, we always knew, was it Korea was the best?
Yeah, the South Koreans have always been very keen on this sort of stuff. They're very keen on very fast internet connections. So, yeah, it's good to see that they're keeping up the...
So what does this mean? Does this mean they've got it available?
Yes.
Or does this mean that they've got more people using it than the rest of the world?
No, they've got it available. The first official ranking of fibre to the house deployments in the world economy has found that 21.2% of homes in Hong Kong are wired with fibre to the house. followed by South Korea at 19.6%. So there you go, Graham. That's a couple. Hong Kong's a bit up on South Korea now. Mm. And Japan was in at 16.3%. And they're a very switched-on technological economy too. So, yeah, it makes you wonder, actually, is fibre to the node really worth it, or should we be looking at fibre to the home here?
Well, it's here, I mean, having markets like that, Hong Kong, South Korea, where it's really, really big, is going to help a great deal because it's going to bring down the cost of all the equipment involved.
But they're very densely
populated. If they're already making that many thousands of all the units, then it's going to make them cheaper for us to use when we go that same way, particularly if we do it 18 months later and everything's half the price. But, yeah, as you say, in South Korea, you know, all the homes are a lot closer together. There's a lot more people per square kilometre than there are here.
It's high-density living there, isn't it?
And that makes a huge difference to the economics of it. So,
because you run one fibre to a block of flats and you might feed hundreds of people.
Well, you might service 1,000 customers as opposed to one or two customers, which you would in the same scenario.
That's right, yeah. If you run the fibre down a suburban street in Melbourne, for example, you know, you might run it past, you know, 50 homes and you might get 5 takers.
Hmm.
And, you know, that's not going to be as economic as if you run the fibre down a street in Seoul and run it past, you know, tens of thousands of residents and get the same proportion of takers.
It's interesting. Scandinavian countries occupy the next 3 positions, with Sweden at 7.2%. Matthew will be pleased. Denmark at 2.9% and Norway at 2.5%.
Yeah, well, Matthew's talked about this in the past, and it's having the option of putting fibre in. You know, the suppliers there, I believe, go to a street and they go to all the residents in the street and say, how many of you are going to show an interest in getting fibre? And if they get enough interest shown, then they'll run the fibre down the street. They sign them up.
Yep.
And run the fibre down the street, and yeah, they've got the customer base. Yeah.
I'd probably be the only one, though, all serious.
And that's the problem, and that's why it won't happen, yeah.
So doesn't this lead the argument to be that wireless, mobile broadband, has got to be...
No, wireless is not the answer for primary delivery. Actual broadcast bandwidth, you know, the spectrum is too rare a resource. The primary delivery has got to be over cables.
Yeah, but in rural areas, I agree with you, in rural areas where bandwidth isn't so much of an issue as compared to potentially city areas, maybe it's an option. Because out of this $4.7 billion fibre to the node network, which I think after the government adds its bit to, it's going to be around about $9 billion, the last 10% of the houses in the country are 50% of that money.
The last 10% is an awful lot. Yeah, I understand what you're saying, but that's still an awful lot to rely on wireless. The wireless should be to pick up the stuff that you just really can't do with cables. Mm. You know, whether it be fibre or whether it be copper, it doesn't matter. But if you can't run a physical line to it, that's where the wireless is for. You know, really, you've got to consider using physical cables one way or another.
Mm. All right, Taiwan, Italy and China, the Netherlands and the US round up the top 11 economies with penetration rates of between 1.4 and 1%. So there you go. The US do get a bit of a mention there, although I don't think their
technology is
much to talk about from what poor old Lyd was saying the other day. She says, I live in Palo Alto. Nothing works here. Oh, dear. So there you go. Silicon Valley. All right. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio, and the concluding sections, we're going to do the odd spot gadget and website of the week. And Dr. Ron will be telling us all about those sort of things after this.
You're listening.
Dr. Ron?
Here I am listening.
Residual powers.
And I've got some residual powers.
You can't turn off CDMA.
In terms of the volume,
motorists have to give fingerprints. Now, this
we may have digressed.
Talk radio.
Bill Burgess also claimed the country would remain behind.
We used to think 600
kilometers. Don't open hands with those good that you're not expecting, even if they do a full clock.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Recently on Tech Talk Radio, we heard Ben-Hur Castro from Seagate in the United States talk about the new generation of portable hard drives, which not only backs up your files with the push of a button, it also password protects the contents of your drive. Not only does the MaxTor OneTouch 4 Plus provide backups, data storage and protection for your files, it also protects your entire computer system in case of disaster. Now for the good news. Thanks to MaxTor, Tech Talk Radio has a 1TB version of the OneTouch to give away to a lucky Tech Talk Radio listener anywhere in the world, valued at $299. All you have to do is visit the Tech Talk Radio website and tell us in a few short words why you need 1TB of storage. How easy is that? We'll announce the winner on air on Monday the 16th of June. So what are you waiting for? Visit techtalkradio.com.au right now and you could be the proud owner of a 1 terabyte, one-touch portable hard drive.
In this house, we obey the laws of thermodynamics!
Tech Talk Radio's Gadget of the Week.
JD, have you got a MacBook Air?
Not yet, no. They're nice and small.
Do you want
they're
one?
They're very expensive.
Oh, I'd love one. Thank you, Apple. Please.
Would you?
Hey, you reckon for over $4,000 for a top-end MacBook Air that they throw in a CD-ROM drive or a DVD-ROM drive?
You'd think they'd include it in the package, but not in the box itself because it makes it too big.
They've done it. That's right. They've done it deliberately so it's designed to be extremely thin, lightweight, and versatile.
That's right, and we were chatting off air, the original Mac laptop, the PowerBook 100, came with no floppy drive.
For the same reason.
They don't have them anymore anyway these days, so they were ahead of
talking about 1989,
yeah, but
though.
They were ahead of their time, weren't they?
This is it. So 20 years on. The gadget of the week is the Apple MacBook Air Super Drive. So if you are desperately needing a DVD drive for your MacBook Air, then this is an add-on gadget for you. That's it. So the MacBook Air doesn't actually have an optical drive or it hasn't got a removable battery. It doesn't have Ethernet. So to make the most of the single lonely USB port there, you might want to connect a super drive. Their website says that the iMac doesn't have a disc tray. The CDs and DVDs slide right into the slot-loading super drive. What makes it super? You can burn your own CDs and DVDs, including double-layered DVDs. That's not bad. So you can use it to back up data or create movies, whatever you want to do. Log on to apple.com/au. The super drive is $139.
But before you buy one, make sure you've got a MacBook Air. It doesn't work on anything else.
Well, there's a good tip. Really? Yes. Only a MacBook Air?
It's just designed for the MacBook Air.
Draws too much power, has a special connector.
Oh, there you go.
See, he knows. That's why he's here.
That's why we'd be paying the big bucks.
Absolutely. Mm. All righty.
Here it is, everybody. The world's greatest website.
Tech Talk Radio website of the week.
Hey, if I say online video sharing, what first jumps into your mind?
Peer-to-peer.
Peer-to-peer? What about a website where you can share videos, given this is
YouTube.
YouTube. Yeah, that's the most common one. Graham, you got any others?
Oh, Google Videos is catching up, isn't it?
Google Videos is catching up. Yeah. The website this week I thought was another one, an alternative online video sharing site called Rever, R-E-V-V-E-R, Rever.com.
I've seen links to that around the place.
Have you?
Yeah.
It's interesting because it's a little bit different because in addition to sharing online media, which is what it's designed to do, its technology actually pairs videos with targeted advertisements and it allows you to track where your videos are being watched on the web. So no matter where your video travels, says the About Us page, you benefit as the uploader because Rever shares advertising revenue with you.
Oh, okay. Google is starting to do that now with their stuff for the top 10 viewers or something.
It's interesting. All you need to do is sign up, create an account and start uploading. It's easy to make and create playlists with Rever, which is what I liked about it. You can share content with other people, obviously, and you can also easily submit popular videos to Dig, to Stumble Upon, to Delicious, to Facebook. It's got links inbuilt so you can easily share and distribute videos.
Yeah, which will help to get your hit rate up and help get more
revenue.
Absolutely,
and get more revenue. So if you're interested, have a look, Rever.com.
There is a fine line between genius and madness.
Showtime. Missed it by that much.
I know nothing. Nothing.
Houston, we have a problem.
The Odd Spot on Tech Talk Radio.
This is a MacBook success story. I thought JD would like this one.
Oh, dear.
Just by the smirk on your face, I think I'm going to enjoy it.
Police in New York have arrested two men after the victim of a burglary remotely photographed the crooks with her stolen MacBook's built-in webcam.
I'll point it out the window. Got them.
So when they turned it on, it sent them a...
When they turned it on, it came online. Ms. Kate Duplagia, I think it's pronounced, had her apartment burgled in April and she lost laptops, a flat-screen television, iPods, gaming consoles, DVDs and computer games. Last week, she noticed that her stolen MacBook had gone online. She signed on to another Mac and activated a Back to My Mac,
yes.
A remote control subscription service.
Back to My Mac.
Miss DePlasia was able to remotely activate the laptop's built-in webcam.
They're not silly, these Apple people.
And photographed a male using her laptop. One of Miss DePlasia's flatmates recognised the thief and they contacted the police. The following day, police his arrested boyfriend. Two men who have since been charged with burglary and possession of stolen property.
Absolutely.
Nah. Isn't that a great story?
What a great success story
technology. Working the right way,
yes,
isn't it?
Indeed it is. So back to my Mac.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure how it works. I think you might have to put an application on your laptop, but essentially it tracks your machine around the world.
My notes here say that it's a remote control subscription service which costs about $140 a year in Australia.
Mm. What a great
and
thing.
You can also contact Apple and let them know something's been stolen. They'll track the serial number if it ever comes in for repair.
Do so they?
There's a few ways of doing that.
That's a good service. I never knew that.
What a great one.
Yeah. Do they repair Macs these days or do they just replace them and give you a new one?
Like the reason they replace motherboards and
the
things.
The reason I asked that is we've had one from the office. It's been gone 4 weeks now and they still haven't returned us. Under warranty too, by the way. All right. That's all we've got time for. It's been great. Until Tech Talk Radio next week at the same station, the same time, the same iPod. I guess. Thanks to everyone, and it's bye for now.
You've been listening to Tech Talk Radio, brought to you each and every week by a group of dedicated professionals from within the media, broadcasting, IT and telecommunications industries. The team consists of executive producer Andrew McComb, producer Dr. Ron Panlis, Graham Callaghan and Mark Diggins, expert opinion Adam Turner, and our US correspondent is Lydia Davis. Post-production facilities courtesy of Evolving Communications. Podcast production by Graham Callaghan. Tech Talk Radio is broadcast, recorded and streamed live to the world each and every Monday night at 8 p.m. from the studios of 3WBC. The crew wish to thank all the stations that take the show, including 3WBC and 3XX in Melbourne, Cairns FM, Switch 1197 in Brisbane, 95.3 Huon FM in Tasmania, Queer FM in WA, and Stop and Go Radio in the United States. For sponsorship and advertising, call 03 9018 9043 or visit our website, techtalkradio.com.au. This has been a production of Tech Talk Radio Vic and is subject to copyright and applicable laws and may not be rebroadcast without approval. We'll